Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Keith Brown, and today I have the pleasure to talk with Joshua Mitchell, who is the author of Tocqueville in Arabia, Dilemmas in a Democratic Movie. Joshua, how are you doing today?
I'm very well, thank you.
This is a really interesting book, a little different book than maybe some of your readers in the past have expected from you. Before we get to this interesting book, maybe you can tell us a little bit about yourself, where you are now, what your background is.
Sure. I have been at Georgetown since 1993, and for most of that time I have been involved in the government department teaching history of Western political philosophy, basically Plato through Nietzsche. And then in 2005, I was given the opportunity to step away from the chair position and get involved with the startup operation for Georgetown School of Foreign Service in Doha, Qatar. And I was very intrigued by the possibility. It's not something that's completely out of my purview. I was actually born in Cairo while my dad was doing research on the Muslim Brotherhood. In fact, his book is still the definitive work on the Brotherhood. And in my early years, because he could not find a job in area studies because those centers did not exist, I actually grew up in Kuwait and in Yemen. So I have long familiarity with the Middle East. And in 2005, as I said, I went to Doha and intended just to stay for 3 years, and did, and then came home and was immediately asked by somebody I had known vicariously to come out to Iraq. And at that point, I thought, sure, I know how to build a university. So I went out and helped him build the American University of Iraq in Kurdistan from 2008 to 2010. And I've been back since, so I've bopped back and forth to the Middle East as well.
Yeah, and the book reflects some of these different stops along your way. And this is not a typical academic book. There was a lot of intellectual discussion in it. I wonder if you talk a little bit about how this book came to be. Did you pitch this to the publisher as it is? Is this a book that you set out to write when you began? Maybe you can give us a little bit of the background.
Well, after 2001 happened, I had, I won't call it a crisis, but I had really decided that the Middle East was my father's work, and I was simply going to do history of Western political philosophy. And when 2001 happened, it brought my world, the world that I had chosen to follow, the Western European American political thought world, into collision with the Middle East. And I wrote an essay which appeared as an epilogue of a book that Gene Beth Elstein and I can't remember who else edited a few years back. And it was a very personal telling of my past history, kind of an autobiographical purging, frankly. And I initially did not think it was going to go further, but I got great encouragement from Gene and a number of others who read it and said, this is an entirely new voice. I have enough German in me that I write very arcane political theory works with 750 footnotes, and I had done three of those. And I kind of sat on it for 2, 3, 4 years, and then when I went to Qatar and started teaching, I realized that what I had begun there needed to be continued. And so I was teaching history of Western political philosophy, and it occurred to me that a new kind of book had to be written. I find a lot of the debates in political theory these days to be very well orchestrated and choreographed, but I'm frankly not pleased with the direction things are moving. Political theory, I think, begins largely because of World War II, and so it's a response to events, an attempt to plumb the depth of Western tradition. There's a view to making sense of those events. It strikes me that that's what political theory needs to do. There was some turn because of 1989, very little because of 2001, almost nothing at all because of the financial crisis of 2007-2008, and I just decided I wasn't going to write another book that way. So I started with the same voice I had in that one epilogue and then asked myself the question, how far can this go? And in the course of my several years in Iraq, Qatar actually, I got a start on it. But frankly, much of it was written in Iraq under very, very difficult circumstances. I was sitting there in my office and was able to reflect about the Middle East as a whole, about U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, about the crisis of modernity, which I think to be very real there in the Middle East. And the book just kind of grew and grew and grew, and it has very few footnotes, as you know, just a few references to pages. There's no substantive footnotes in the book. And I shopped it around, and a number of publishers thought that it was well written, but they said, well, this just isn't the kind of thing they do. So I talked to John Frenescu at the University of Chicago, who published my first two books. And it was a long shot, because they generally don't do this sort of thing, but he read it and he said, well, you know, we do lots of Tocqueville, and I think we want to do this one. So it was a happy surprise that John picked it up after my last book, which was 1995 with them. So there you have it.
And a lot of the book is reflections on literature, but also reflections on your own past and also the past of your students. Recall a conversation in 2005 that you had at a cafe.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could recount a little bit of this conversation and what you took from it, because it really does set up a lot of questions that go on in the book. So tell us about that conversation.
Well, in other parts of the book, I have extended reflections on the 1960s, and I do that for a number of reasons. First, the book is not just written for an American audience. It's written for my Middle Eastern students as well, who don't really understand the 60s. Second, you know, the other great book about the 60s that's within our orbit is Alan Bloom's Closing the American Mind. And I wanted to both, in a way, amplify his thoughts, but to show that it wasn't just the 1960s. It was something so much deeper going on. It was a part of a general movement that Tocqueville had seen happen, or seen developing, you know, 170 years ago, 180 years ago. So that was one of the reasons I moved in that direction. So I'd always, the 60s was very powerful for me. I grew up in Ann Arbor, lots of things happened there. And then when I met this gentleman in Saudi Arabia, or from Saudi Arabia, who is really the first substantive person you're introduced to in the book, I realized that the 60s was not just America, that there was a 60s generation in Europe, that, as I say in my book, that they too were interested in throwing off their fathers, but that meant something very, very different to them. It meant throwing off the legacy of national wars, and so whereas in America, throwing off our fathers meant innovation and experimentation, in Europe, what it meant was throwing off the fathers of their nations and so creating the European Union. And then, as I note in the book, this very wise man said, you don't understand, we too had a 60s generation, and like you, we were throwing off our fathers. And the fathers that we were throwing off had made this halfway capitulation to the West, which we found very unpalatable. And so you have a 60s generation in Saudi Arabia, which in some of its parts became interested in the process of what Tocqueville and Rousseau and Weber would call the re-enchantment of the world and the return to Islamic fundamentalism. So three different 60s generations, three ways of throwing off the fathers. I raised this notion of throwing off the fathers because this is Tocqueville's fundamental claim, that the breaking of the links between the generations that you once had in the aristocratic age is characteristic of the democratic age. And it seemed to me that this would be a way to introduce an issue that's larger than the 60s generation, introduce the grand movement of history, which is the delinking of persons.
Much of the discussions about actually teaching Tocqueville in this new environment, that a new campus that you're a part of, and you teach this course, which I think you've taught many times in the States, about the history of Western political thought. And in that class, Tocqueville appears somewhat late in the syllabus, later in the semester, I would imagine. I wonder what you expected the reaction of your students to be to Tocqueville before you had the chance to teach it and preparing to teach it for the first class. What did you anticipate their reaction to it based on your previous teaching?
Well, in the book I mentioned that my first exposure to international students was not actually in Qatar. I had moved back and forth to Latin America for three summers before 2001. And what I had encountered there was a great deal of resistance to liberal thought, broadly understood, economic liberalism, political liberalism. And this, of course, had happened after 1989, when in North America the understanding was that Karl Marx had been repudiated. And my wonderment there in Latin America, and also in Lisbon, where I taught for a bit, was how the kind of triumphal understanding of liberalism had not taken hold down there. They were deeply, deeply suspicious of liberalism, as I say in the book. They had a kind of tacit appreciation and endorsement of Marx and Rousseau without having read them, and a deep suspicion of Smith. So I had already had some encounter with Latin American and European, let's call them anti-modern tropes, anti-modern suspicions. And when I went to the Middle East, I knew there would be something like that, but I think the big surprise was that the language was almost identical. So it didn't matter that these young people came from a different religious tradition. It didn't matter that, whereas in Argentina, standards of living were falling, whereas in Qatar and Lisbon, they were rising at that time. None of that mattered. And what struck me then was that there had to be some larger explanation for why young people around the globe spoke really unreflectively using the exact same tropes, kind of anti-modern tropes. And what occurred to me was that colonialism had an awful lot to do with it, that either because of European education going there or because the young people over generations had gone to Europe, they had imbibed a certain suspicion of the liberal project, and there are, of course, a lot of European thinkers who have that, Rousseau, Marx, Nietzsche, Heidegger. And so what I was hearing, though it was ostensibly an authentic Muslim response, was actually not that. It was intermixed anti-modern tropes along with the Islamic positions they were trying to make. So the mystery became why it was these anti-modern tropes are so prevalent. And at that point, I realized that Tocqueville was even more important than I had thought, because this was what Tocqueville was writing about in the 1830s. Democracy in America is not written for Americans. It's written for the French, who are wrestling with the question, can we go back and re-enchant the world? Can we save the aristocratic past? Or how do we live in this democratic age? So I was expecting of my students a certain resistance to Democracy in America because it seemed to be a book about America. I was quickly able to dispel that. But then when they started voicing their serious concerns, it sounded remarkably like what I'd heard in Buenos Aires and in Lisbon. So at that point, I realized that there was a kind of global challenge here, which Tocqueville had seen already, which was, in the face of this movement into what he called the democratic age, how are people going to respond to it? And he had very clear understanding. They would try to re-enchant the world, or they would try to overthrow the current delinquent condition through revolution. And that's why Tocqueville, in my view, and I think I convinced my students, is the political theorist or social theorist for the 21st century, because he confronts the problem that everyone around the world is faced with, namely, how do you deal with modernity?
Now, who were these students that you taught there? Where were they headed after your class? Have you been in touch with any of them? We all hope that our teaching stays with our students. But I wonder, given what you interpret as a pretty meaningful experience in discussing this literature, gather that this has fit into their next 8 years or 4 years or 5 years. What role does it play in the lives of the students that now live after the class?
Yeah. Well, we were really lucky. The first-year students, whenever there's a college that starts up, the first-year students are always going to be the ones who take the biggest risk, and their parents are willing to endorse that. So we had a spectacular first-year class, and some of them were Qataris, but I want to be clear, the book Tocqueville in Arabia is not just a series of reflections on my series of reflections on the Qatari students, because the students came from the Levant, they came from India, they came from the Philippines in one case. We also had some from Eastern Europe. We actually had a Marine who was stationed there, who had finished up and wanted to join too. So it was this really wonderful group of about 20 or so, 24 students from Qatar, but really around the world. So it wasn't just Qatari students. it took time. And I had them over the course of several years, and what I've realized is that you have to build a relationship of trust, of course, with American students, but when you're overseas, it takes a little bit longer, and I think the key there is just to listen. And I tell my colleagues that I learned more about Western political thought while I was teaching them, because I had to listen to questions of the sort I would never, ever get in the United States. So, for example, in the United States, when I teach elements of political theory to my undergraduates, it is universally true for all of them, the 100 of them or so that are in my class, that democracy is the highest political form. In Qatar, there were students, and I don't remember, I think some of them might have been Qataris, but they weren't just Qataris, who would look at me and say, "Professor Mitchell, you don't understand. Constitutional monarchy is the highest form of government, and your American students are so disillusioned or so delusional that they don't understand the highest political form here." So I was dealing with a universe of ideas that were completely different than the ones on the main campus. So that was refreshing for me. The second author I teach was St. Augustine, City of God. And I had no trepidation about it. I think there's some sense that in the Middle East, they don't want to talk about Christianity, they don't want to talk about religion. And I'm sure in some quarters that's true, but I had really, really refreshing conversations with my Muslim students about Christianity. They range broadly in terms of what they want to do. Some are very well connected because of their families. Others, not so much. Some of them stayed, some of them left. I left before the first class graduated, but I heard secondhand that they were running up and down the halls always talking about Tocqueville. So I took this to be a very serious success. And when I go back there this spring, I'm going to be teaching my Tocqueville class again. So, it's a great group of students. Some of them will end up being political leaders. Others will be in business. Others will drift off and do who knows what. But it was really a wonderful group of students.
Yeah, I wonder, you end the book with an epilogue that reflects a little bit about your more recent experiences with Iraq. How does this conclude, maybe with your philosophical thought, and how this connects, you know, either to your rebuilding, reconstruction efforts in Iraq, and or, you know, how this has impacted how you teach back in the States? Has this changed your pedagogy or your scholarship on Tocqueville? What is the next step for you?
Well, the book is, even though I spent 2 full years in Iraq, the book is largely about Qatar, in part because had I written about Iraq, it would have been a very different kind of book. I dealt with immense political pressures there and challenges that it's just impossible to convey in a few sentences, or I don't think I could do it in the book. It was a post-war zone, and tremendous distrust. It was a safe area, but I had AK-47 carrying bodyguards, and we had to tell our students to leave their rifles in the trunk when they came to school. And it wasn't that we were ever felt there was an imminent threat, but when you're in a place that's had war for such a long time, people just carry guns, and it's just part of life. So it would have been a different kind of book. That said, the students I encountered were, in one decisive respect, not different than the others I've encountered around the world. They're students who wrestle with what it means to be modern. The problem is exacerbated because of all the new social media technology. On the one hand, this group of students is identical to our American students in that they have Facebook, text messages, the whole nine yards, Twitter, and in that sense, they have the kind of liberation from their parents and their larger social setting that our kids have, but they're also very, very tied to their families in ways that most Americans can't understand, and so they are torn in ways that our students aren't, and they're desperately looking for answers. The old educational system there is not going to work anymore. It's a complete rote memorization method. And these kids who have a suppleness of mind to realize the world is changing know that that education isn't going to work anymore. So I have come away thinking that, well, not surprisingly, bombs and bullets are not always the best way to go, and that there is something that America can do, because it does it relatively well, And the really happy news is that around the globe, ministries of higher education are clamoring for it, namely United States or American higher education. So I've come away thinking that the next great challenge is global higher education. And I think particularly for political theory, this is important because, as I said at the outset, so many of the debates have become sterile, and there's a growing suspicion that the canon could do anything for us. My view is that the canon is incredibly important now. In fact, it's more important now than it ever has been. But I don't mean it as a defense for an existing tradition. I mean it rather as a kind of resume of the existential possibilities that a civilization can know. And so I want to bring those books from each canon into conversation. And it strikes me that that's really the challenge of the 21st century for young people around the globe, because in the Middle East, they will quickly tell you that what I call liberal triumphalism is not going to work, that democracy is not going to come. And then many of them will launch into a kind of indignation using post-colonial tropes, and I'll sit and listen and say, yes, you're absolutely right about all the injustices that you have incurred at the hands of the West. And then I say to them, and now how are you going to build a world? And they don't have an answer. Now, the happy news is there are a number of young people who realize that they're going to have to plumb their own traditions to figure out how they're going to move forward. And this, to me, is a spectacular development. And if we can set up global education to be able to help retrieve that, then I think we can have the kind of civilizational global conversations that we need to have. And as I said, the happy news for political theory is that that raises it up from the dead, where it more or less is now. And then it can make a real serious contribution to global education.
Yeah, I think as you can all tell, this is a book that's deep in theory, but also in some ways a travelogue, and also about pedagogy. It also has one of the better book covers, I think, of the year. Dr. Basil's book, Focus on Arabia, Dilemmas in the Democratic Age, published by University of Chicago Press in 2013. I'd recommend it to lots of different audiences. Joshua, thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Sure.